Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Tonight, we will again discuss the topic, Stand Your Ground Law, and whether it should be revised or repealed. This is one of the hottest topics or debates in the country right now, and here are my thoughts. The Stand Your Ground Law, at its core, could have been and should have been a good law. However, it was poorly drafted, leaving a window for a person to commit murder and get off using stand your ground as their defense. I think everyone agrees you should have the right to protect yourself and your castle without a need to retreat. However, things get fuzzy when the law says you have the right to use deadly force if you reasonably believe such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to yourself or another, or prevent the imminent commission of a forcible felony. Tonight we will explore the term reasonable. Should that term be removed and a less broad term replace it? The term reasonable implies we all have the same way of looking at things, and that simply is not true. We will also explore whether an addendum should be added that states, if it was safe to do so, you exhausted all attempts to defuse the altercation or retreated without success before using deadly force. So, before your ground is used as a person's defense, the person should prove the threat was real, and the evidence should support that. Otherwise, stand your ground, as it stands today, only adds to the atmosphere of shoot first, ask questions later. Tonight, our topic is Stand Your Ground Laws, Self-Defense or License to Kill. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. So let's get started. I see most of my panelists here, so we're going to introduce the ones that are here, and we're going to pick up the other ones later. First, we have Attorney Troy Weber with Hussein and Weber out of Jacksonville, Florida. We also have Attorney Tom Wright with Siegel, Siegel, and Wright out of Boca Raton, Florida. Also with us is Attorney Andrew Ryer of Miami, Florida. And the fourth number, I'm not certain, but I believe that's Attorney Don Wilkerson of Honolulu, Hawaii. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Is Mr. Wilkerson with us?
Carrie, that might be me.
Okay. You're calling it. Dr. Zoe Spencer is with us, and she's calling in from a number I did not recognize. Good evening,
I'm sorry.
Dr. How are you?
Good evening, everyone.
Okay, y'all heard my intro. And so that said, you know, stand your ground really needs to be defined. And thank God we have several attorneys from the state of Florida where the George Zimmerman trial took place at. And actually, Attorney Troy Weber once was the assistant public defender in the 18th Judicial Circuit of Florida, which was
correct.
The circuit that was governing Sanford, Florida. Is that correct, Mr. Weber?
That is correct.
Okay. So for us, if you would, so we all get some clarity, you know, explain stand your ground in Florida. What does it mean, the law stand your ground in Florida?
This is directed to me, Troy Weber. Just want to make sure.
Yes,
are you directing this to me? Okay.
Well,
I think to understand stand your ground, the best way to approach it is to understand what the law was in Florida prior to the enactment of the statute in 2005. The principle that a person could use deadly force if they reasonably believed that there was an imminent threat of death or serious bodily harm, that has been the law in Florida for well over a century. And you can find cases going back to the 1890s with courts announcing that type of rule being an application. So what stand your ground does is it didn't create that rule. That's been the law in Florida since time immemorial, and I suspect that's the law in almost all states. But what it does is it abolishes a duty of retreat. Okay, because in common law, what you had to do, unless you were in your house or at your place of business, is you had a duty to retreat. You had to retreat to the wall, and that was a duty you owed to your attacker, believe it or not, unless you were in your home. In which case, he didn't have a duty to retreat, and that's something known as the Castle Doctrine. So what stand your ground is, in my view, it's really an expansion of the self-defense doctrine that existed in Florida for well over a century. And it's an expansion because it eliminates this duty of retreat.
So
that's the best way of summarizing it.
That's the way of summarizing it. So when George Zimmerman's defense team originally said that we're going to use stand your ground as his defense, why do you think they changed it?
What do you mean they? What did they change?
Initially, they said that stand your ground was going to be George Zimmerman's defense, since you're familiar with Stanford and Florida and that area. They were going to originally use stand your ground, and at the last minute, I believe, they changed it and said it was just going to be self-defense and not stand your ground defense.
You're looking at stand your ground and self-defense as these two disjointed things, and actually it's not. The rule which the statute in 2005 announced is part of the self-defense instruction. It's there in the standard jury instructions that you don't have a duty to retreat if you're in a place where you have a lawful right to be. So I don't know that they ever said, well, we're not going to raise the defense.
Can I interject?
Sure, go ahead, Dr.
I think what you're talking about too, I mean, and I'm not an attorney, but in dealing with stand your ground, there's an immunity clause in even Florida statute. And when you're dealing with stand your ground, the stand your ground allows a person who, you know, may have been involved in a homicide to first not be arrested, not be prosecuted. So once an individual is prosecuted, then the immunity portion of stand your ground no longer exists. So I think, you know, we're talking about two different things. Self-defense is a claim after a person has been, after a case has been input or whatever the word is, but stand your ground, people don't get arrested and they don't get prosecuted. So there is a degree of immunity that if a person feels that the person operated within this code, and I believe it's Florida Code 776-041, that they don't get prosecuted. So,
if I may place it, it's not quite that way. In reality, stand your ground, immunity portion you're talking, I'm sorry, this is Tom Wright. The immunity portion you're talking about is the ability of a defendant to raise basically a motion before the court in order to avoid a trial going any further. And what it is you have to actually prove by a preponderance of evidence that you have the right to defend yourself if you're facing deadly force. Now, that's a much higher burden of proof than one needs to establish for innocence. You only need, you know, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt somebody's guilty. But in order to basically gain immunity, understand your ground, you have to have a preliminary motion which suggests to the court, look at this evidence. There is enough here by a preponderance of the evidence to suggest that I have the right to defend myself, at which point the court has dropped the case and they can no longer prosecute. It's not a guarantee that you're not going to get arrested. If somebody's involved in a homicide and say, hey, I want to raise the standard ground defense, that's not going to prevent them from being arrested. That's something that's really going to be raised in a preliminary motion by the defense counsel. And then the thing is, even if that's denied, the case still goes to trial and the jury is still going to receive instructions on self-defense, which basically include stand your ground provisions suggesting you don't have a duty to retreat under certain circumstances.
So
yeah, I agree with that, Carrie. This is Andrew Ryer in Miami, okay. And in fact, I have a murder case where we did exactly what Tom just described. We filed a motion to dismiss, and we're getting a ruling on Tuesday. And if we win, the case is dismissed without going to trial. What I think, Terry, you were saying, which is true, is that they did imply they were going to seek stand your ground, but they actually, in the Zimmerman case, never filed the motion, which was surprising to me because, I mean, I'll defer to some of the other attorneys, but I've had four murder cases, two murder cases, two manslaughter cases dismissed by arguing that motion. And you really, it's a great tool as a defense attorney. I'm not discussing the morality of it or the ethics, but strictly as a self-defense tool. I mean, it's a way to get a case dismissed without going to trial. Now, I'm sure Tom and the other attorneys in Miami or Florida will agree with me on one important point. The problem is, if you do a stand your ground motion, your best chance of winning is if you put your client on the stand. And the problem with putting your client on the stand is now he's out there. And from what I understood, just from reading the articles, I wasn't part of the Zimmerman team. I didn't speak to the lawyers firsthand. I think they had a genuine concern, given the fact that, you know, for whatever reason, they allowed him to do an interview with Sean Hannity, which I think was played to disastrous results during the trial. They wanted to fight that. I think they had genuine concern about putting their client on the stand, because judges, if you're going to argue a stand your ground motion and they're going to dismiss a case where somebody perished or somebody was shot, they're going to want to hear from your defense, and they're going to want the defendant to answer the questions by the prosecutor. So, of course, the risk is, if you argue a stand your ground motion pre-trial and you litigate it and you put your client on the stand and you lose, the state now has deposition of the defendant, which under the Fifth Amendment, they can't get any other way, especially if your client had made a previous statement. In the case I have Tuesday, where I'm going to get a ruling, I'm concerned because my client gave two different 45-page type statements, yet I still believe we couldn't win the case without our client testifying. So if we win, it's great, but if we lose, now the state has two different recorded statements, and now they have a third statement that they got from the Stand Your Ground case, where in the Zimmerman case, they actually, you know, he cooperated all along. He spoke to the police, and there were some basic questions he couldn't answer for the police or gave, you know, somewhat ridiculous answers. And then you had his interview with Sean Hannity, where, I mean, some of the answers, you know, were really exploited by the prosecution, and the case ended in not guilty. But there were still problems for the defense in some of their client statements. And I can't speak to anything other than my own experience. The only reason I thought they wouldn't argue stand your ground, because it's possible they could have won the case pre-trial, is they didn't want Mr. Zimmerman to be questioned by the state. And, you know, they rested without calling.
Yeah, but I think that's the second. But can I interject? But that's the second part of the story, though. Then if that's the case, because the initial issue and the issue that caused so much resistance was the fact that he was not arrested in the first place, and it was only after resistance and national protest that he was arrested. And one of the grounds that they were using to justify him not being arrested and him not being charged before the protest was that they were giving him immunity under Stand Your Ground. So can someone explain that to me?
I can jump in there, Terry, if I can.
Okay.
This is Troy Weber again, by the way. You know, before police make an arrest, they've got to ensure that there's probable cause that a violation of the law has occurred. And if the law states that there's no duty to retreat and that you reasonably fear for, you know, for your life or limb and of course, a physical altercation, if that's what the law is, and the evidence in the eyes of the police at the time suggested that there was this physical altercation and that George Zimmerman did act defensively, then arguably they could have concluded they didn't have the probable cause. So that may be the explanation. But it's not because the law said that George Zimmerman couldn't be arrested. It's because police made the decision that, for whatever reason, they didn't have the probable cause to make the arrest.
Let me ask something on the George Zimmerman situation. You know, juror B-29 just came out and did an interview with Good Morning America the other day, and she said he's guilty. You know, basically we let him get off with murder. Well, of course that's not going to go over well with everybody. That said, is there anything that can be done at this point? We know that Eric Holder's, the Department of Justice, is thinking about opening an investigation. What can be done at this point?
Well, you have civil rights remedies. This is Andrew Ryer in Miami. You have 1983 civil rights remedies, but I think that the federal government is going to tread cautiously on them, given the fact that, you know, I'll let the other attorneys speak to it. I mean, you haven't asked me my moral opinion of Stand Your Ground, but strictly as a defense attorney, it's pretty powerful, and everything described about the self-defense claim is exactly right. There's no duty to retreat. which means usually you could only use lethal force if lethal force was presented. Now you can use lethal force if you perceive lethal force will be used, even if the person is unarmed, even if you just reasonably have a fear. So, I mean, you can drive a truck through that loophole. And, in fact, there were National Rifleman Association lobbyists that helped draft the legislation and drafted in 20 states. So the federal government could go under 1983.
Speak up a little bit, Andrew. Somebody's got to think on their line.
Sure. The federal government can pursue civil rights violations on behalf of Trayvon Martin, which, by the way, we follow closely here in Miami. Trayvon Martin went to Michael Kropp High School, which is the high school district I live in. It's my son's school district. So, I mean, this case was followed very closely here. And what I can tell you is that that's going to be an uphill battle, I think, for the federal government. The other issue is, which I think you were implying, is can anything be done about the jury verdict? Now, generally, it's a defense attorney who will be raising questions about a jury verdict because we as defense attorneys have the right to appeal convictions. The state does not have the right to appeal a final acquittal. So that's number one. But number two, what happens, and I'll refer this to some of the other attorneys, you know, there's a big difference between what happened for these jurors, because remember, these jurors were sequestered. They were cloistered away from all media coverage on this case. They did shopping excursions, but they didn't have access to media coverage of the case.
But that's not completely true, Andrew. Remember, the sheriff's department came forward and said there were times that he left them unsupervised with family members and friends. So those people could have possibly given them information about what was being said in the media.
I mean, we don't have direct evidence of that, but I can't say you're wrong. It would be assumptions. It's conceivable. But the point that I'm trying to make is, now that this case is out there, now that the media coverage and the groundswell of protests around the country have come out, I mean, it's very possible that that affected, you know, some of the jurors' opinions from when they left. I mean, to the juror who came back and came back saying that she was originally guilty, and then changed her verdict. I can tell you that when I call a jury, one of the questions I ask a jury is, will you stand your ground in that jury room? Are you going to change your mind, even if it's five people one way, and you're the sixth person? Remember, we're different in Florida than other states. We only have a six-person jury, unless it's a capital case. And there are 12-person jurors in federal court. And what I tell my jury are, look, if it's Friday at 4:30, and I'm sure many of these lawyers have been in the same situation when it's Friday at 4:30 and all of a sudden they come, are you going to change your mind to go home, to go to your family, or are you going to stand your ground in it? And are you going to, if you believe that the other five are wrong, are you going to not change your verdict just for the sake of changing it? And what happened to the juror on Good Morning America, if you listen to her interview, which I did, is she changed her mind. And she was one of two people, I think, or one person, for murder two. And, you know, they ended up acquitting. And why did they do that? Because the other jurors will beat you down. I mean, and that could go either for conviction or for acquittal. And what you could have had was a hung jury where the judge reads what's called an Allen charge to try to get the jury to break a deadlock. But there never was a deadlock. There never was a request by this jury that they were in a deadlock, and as such, the juror simply changed her mind. And for the prosecution, there's no appellate remedy that I'm aware of.
Now, Tom Wright, the fact that it was six women on a jury, how often does that happen? I mean, would you have chosen six women to be on your jury in a case like this, like the Zimmerman trial?
Well, here's the thing. It's not like I would get to handpick a jury. That would be a lovely privilege of a defense attorney to just, to pick.
But you have the right to exclude people.
Well, you do, but so does the prosecution. So what happens is, I mean, you're getting a combination of eliminated jurors and strikes and whatnot, and you end up with a pool that, quite frankly, in most instances, neither the prosecution is completely pleased with, nor is defense counsel. You know, it's a combination of people. Nobody's going to get it exactly the way they want it. I mean, unless one side is just going to lay down and let the other side just bowl over them.
I mean, I think the real sad part about this whole thing is that a lot of the protests that are going on, and, you know, you're seeing performance artists like, I believe, Jay-Z and Stevie Wonder and other people say, you know, well, I'm going to boycott the law based with these kind of laws and whatnot. A lot of this uproar really stems, sadly, from a lack of understanding of the law. A lot of people seem to think that the only reason that Trayvon Martin is dead is because of Stand Your Ground. And there's no correlation between the two, really. This is a matter of a self-defense case where a jury determined under these circumstances that it was reasonable. Now, another jury might have said, we don't think it's reasonable. You know, you have 10 juries, you might get 5 verdicts one way and 5 the other. It's subjective upon the jurors because they're the triers of fact. There isn't an objective standard in the law as to whether something is reasonable or not. That is the latitude that we give to the jurors. And it's not a perfect system, it never will be, but I'll be damned, it's one of the best ones in the world. And, you know, whenever anybody looks to what justice should be around the world, they tend to look at the U.S. system.
Can I interject for a second? Because I think I would like to add a different context to that. And I think the term reasonable and the term fear, I mean, I hear the attorney speaking from a legal perspective, but I think that we also, you know, have to understand, and, you know, a lot of people don't understand when it's not their experience and not their struggle, that we're also operating from a historical factor. And so, you know, Trayvon Martin's death is not just about self-defense. That's the legal claim, and that's when you get into the court system and the legal justification for it. But I think people have to understand on a grander scale, which the courts don't address, and it's not their job to address it in the court system, but, you know, when you're talking about uproar and the protest and what have you, you have to understand that that thing is coming from a historical perspective where black men have historically been subjected to lynching, and this whole concept of accountability, especially when you're dealing with the racial dynamics of lynching and the historical dynamics of lynching, where you're dealing with white assailants murdering black men and not being held accountable and being protected from any kind of prosecution or any kind of legal accountability. So I think the uproar is really coming from that understanding and that experience that does not get expressed in the law. And then I want to go back to the legal perspective as well, because one of the questions that the protest is raising is, George Zimmerman had a quote-unquote right to defend himself. But then when you're talking about reasonable and you're talking about fear, I think those subjective concepts of reasonable and fear is what negated Trayvon Martin's ability or his ability to be present in that moment and to have fear and to have defended himself. Because when you look at the whole structure of the case, Trayvon Martin was cut out of his ability to have feared George Zimmerman following him. And then the trial begins at the point of contact and not before then, and I think that speaks largely to the history.
But I think you're proving my point here. In other words, you're suggesting, okay, if I was on that juror panel, that you would have seen the evidence in a different light, and that's completely your right. The trick is, in this particular panel of jurors, that's the way they interpreted the evidence. Now, obviously, none of us are privy to all the evidence that they saw there unless we sat down for the entire proceeding. None of us are there to hear the quality of the testimony of the various witnesses, how well things are presented and how aren't. All we're seeing are the excerpts and the little, you know, bullet points and throwing our sense in there. And it just doesn't always work that way. I mean, I can read a transcript from a proceeding and come up with one opinion, whereas if I'm actually sitting there and seeing the quality of a witness, I can have a completely different impression of things.
Yeah, but I think when you're applying the law, and that's another part of the problem, I mean, you know, I did sit through the trial and I did watch the trial, you know, but I think when you're applying the law, even when it comes to jury instruction and where jury instruction or where the juries are instructed to begin What's the point of your deliberation? Where does the incident begin and where does it end? And I think even with jury instruction, and I'm no lawyer, perhaps I should have gone to law school instead of doing what I did, but, you know, you have to look at the fact that it doesn't begin and end with the altercation. It begins with George Zimmerman following Trayvon Martin. And
well,
I think
doctor, I'd like to pick up on that point, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
This is Andrew Ryer.
Hold that thought 1 second, y'all, because we got to go to the phone line, so I want to put that out there. You all,
don't forget, Andrew.
We'll respond back to that, Andrew, and then we're going to go to area code 314 and area code 513. Pick up on that.
Is it okay if I respond?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, I can give you a different perspective because I'm a Caucasian criminal defense lawyer in Miami, but I'm also a student of history, and I think, unfortunately, you know, and like I said, Trayvon Martin attended my school district here in North Miami Beach, and I think that unfortunately, for, you know, the rest of our history, Trayvon Martin's name will be spoken about as Emmett Till's name is spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
For African Americans, where somebody who was unarmed, was in the wrong place at the wrong time, was killed, and there was no repercussions for the people who did it to Emmett Till, and there'll be no repercussions for the person that did it to Trayvon Martin. And I understand what Tom was saying about the law, and I think even President Jimmy Carter, who is no right-wing person, said that the way the law is written, the jury came up with the right verdict. And, I mean, I heard Troy speak earlier, and I agree with Troy. The critical issue with where, you know, Tom, maybe, you know, stand your ground wasn't on the jury instruction or wasn't on the verdict form, but clearly the elimination of the duty to retreat and the need to present lethal force, that amendment to where now you don't have to present lethal force, is the only reason that George Zimmerman legally could have been acquitted. He was specifically told by that dispatcher to break off contact. He pursued Trayvon Martin, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a father of a 15-year-old that wears a hoodie but is white, you know, I mean, I can't stand to hear people say that wearing a hoodie sweatshirt is somehow equivalent to, you know, dressing like a gangbanger. And I could see, you know, not walking it, just walking a mile in someone else's shoes. You know, I remember seeing the political cartoon of the boy telling his mother that he's going out, you know, to buy a drink at the convenience store, and the mother hugging him and crying, and then being African-American. And I think that spoke eloquently, you know, not to what we deal with as defense attorneys or defense, but what we see, you know, now is the reality that, let's face it, you know, and I will defer to the African-American members of this panel, but, you know, we have DWB driving while black, and I can't tell you how many of my friends who are attorneys who are African-American have their license and registration in their pocket. And I would ask my friend when I went for a ride from him, why are you doing that? He goes, well, you know, I get pulled over a lot. And I can tell you that I don't always drive the speed limit, and I don't get pulled over that much. And, you know, I can't say that that doesn't have anything to do with race. So from an African-American perspective, from a historical perspective, it's very fair the fact that conservatives that wrote this legislation and eliminated the duty to retreat and made it easier for guys like us to get not guilty for our client definitely created a situation now where you don't need to see a weapon. You don't need to even be attacked. You just need to have a reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm, and you can kill somebody legally.
And you guys, you know what, there's some people that want to talk to y'all. Listen, this is a panel. Listen, I couldn't dream of a better panel tonight, y'all. We got three attorneys from Florida and a sociology professor. So it doesn't get much better than this. Y'all, we got to go to the phone lines and get some of these questions. We're going to go to area code 314-381. Good evening. You're on center stage.
You know, I just want to make some comments. You know, Emmett Till was murdered. Trayvon Martin was killed from action of self-defense. So I don't know how you can compare the two in this case. Another
both
thing.
Both were unjust.
Pardon me?
Both were unjust. What was Trayvon Martin killed for walking? Why was Emmett Till killed? Because he was.
Well, the jury came back and found Trayvon not guilty. I mean, Zimmerman not guilty. But here's the point. I keep hearing this, people say that Zimmerman use too much force. If I'm a 240-pound right-handed person, and I'm a grown man, and my assailant is less than 21, do I hit him with my left hand? And if he's over 21, do I hit him with my right hand? Ooh. And I'm trying to defend myself.
Well, you were the aggressor, though, so, you know, if you had...
No, I'm defending myself. And this person is the felon. So what did I do? In a case like that, at a time like that, a person does what they have to do. As long as it's... eventually he did what he had to do.
And
I mean, it's unfortunate.
You said deadly force was justified.
Did I say deadly force was justified?
Yes.
Well, was deadly force illegal?
But you know what, Carrie?
That's the point, isn't it?
Deadly force
is not illegal. And that's the problem.
And I would like the attorneys to speak to something for me, because I am still, and I'm listening to everybody speak, and everybody is talking about reasonable fear and self-defense, and I'm trying to find out what part of the law, because the defense, which was brilliant, the defense was that George Zimmerman felt in fear of his life, and he had a reason to meet force with force and to use excessive force and kill Trayvon Martin. But what I'm trying to figure out is, where did Trayvon Martin lose his right to also be afforded equal protection under the law? Where did Trayvon Martin, because the whole concept, the whole defense was that Trayvon Martin was straddling George Zimmerman and bashing his head on the ground, and George Zimmerman feared for his life, and he shot him. If it's about reasonable fear and no duty to retreat, and I hear everybody who argues about it, they always say, well, Trayvon Martin should have run home. Why didn't he run home? I even heard Juror B37 say, well, he should have run home. My question is, where is the law, or where does the law state that Trayvon Martin, or what is the exclusion where Trayvon Martin is not afforded the same protection under that same law, which then would have completely dismantled the defense's claim? Can somebody explain that to me?
I can. Trayvon Martin was not on trial. He was not the defendant. And because Trayvon Martin is not the defendant, he's not. The law doesn't really apply to him. Unfortunately, Trayvon Martin is no longer alive.
But when you're dealing with the defense, though, because, no, he's not alive, and in the case of Stand Your Ground, the person who is the recipient of the bullet or of death is never going to be there or on trial. And I would, you know, hypothetically or, you know, really figuratively, I would say that Trayvon Martin was probably more on trial than George Zimmerman was. But even though he was not on trial, does that mean that he is excluded posthumously from being afforded the same protection under the law? Had Trayvon Martin killed George Zimmerman when George Zimmerman approached him, he should have been afforded, if we're talking about the equal application of the law, Trayvon Martin should have been afforded his own reasonable fear of an imminent threat of danger or great bodily injury. He should have been afforded that.
Okay. The best I can tell you, Doctor, is that under 1983 in federal protection, the federal government can pick up the charges, and Eric Holder said he's investigating it. And I'll call for it. I'll let some other people talk. But there can be a violation of Trayvon Martin's civil rights.
Absolutely.
And if the federal government, if the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Justice Department determines that Trayvon Martin's civil rights were violated,
absolutely,
they can find a cause of action against George Zimmerman.
Okay, we're going to find out what Troy and Tom are about to say before we go to caller 513. Okay, who is that jumping in, Troy or Tom?
Maybe Tom, I'm not really sure.
Okay. Whoever was jumping in, go ahead.
I think the caller's argument, I mean, she was correct in the sense, if this was a case where Trayvon had not actually been killed, let's say it was an aggravated battery where he was very, very seriously harmed by Mr. Zimmerman, let's say he was shot but wasn't killed, okay, then the evidence is going to come in on either side as to who did what and who is justified in using what kind of force. But the problem is we can only apply the law, sadly, to the person who is on trial. Or is, you know, evidence is being presented upon. You know, Trayvon never lost his rights per se. Trayvon's rights, in a weird way, are being exercised through the prosecution of Mr. Zimmerman in the first place. In other words, if nobody was concerned about Trayvon's rights, they wouldn't have bothered to prosecute the guy in the first place.
And they didn't.
But, so, well, you know, I guess it's a matter of opinion.
No, that's a fact. They didn't. It took national protest to get the prosecution to even prosecute the case in the first place because they weren't going there in the first place.
That doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong. I mean, there are many people I've talked to, some pretty preemptive bull minds out there, that suggest that the only reason this actually went to trial was because of public pressure.
Absolutely.
When it probably shouldn't have. Sadly, okay? If you're asking me whether or not I agree with the verdict, it's pretty hard for me to pass that judgment. It's terrible that this kid is not around. It's always an absolute tragedy when anybody has to lose their life in these kind of situations. But all we can deal as a society with the system we have is to address it under the set of laws that we've established in legislation. And obviously when laws are viewed as being imperfect, that's when the legislature will jump in, hopefully, and correct them. You know? And I mean, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't. The editors of the House of Representatives up in Tallahassee, and I saw more laws botched up than I could shake a stick at. You know, for every good law that went through, I'd see some that were absolutely ludicrous, or drafted so poorly that they were just incomprehensible.
I'm sorry.
See, I think 713 wants to talk to y'all. We're gonna go to area code 513-724. Good evening, you're on center stage.
Hi, Carrie. Hi, this is Peggy.
Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Peggy. Hi, how are y'all?
Peggy's Howard. And we're going to start talking about some specific cases since Peggy's on the line. Peggy's brother, Mark Howard, was killed in West Columbia, South Carolina. Dr. Zoe Spencer, you were the family advocate on that particular case. You want to explain what happened with Mark Howard and how Stand Your Ground was invoked by the shooter and how that whole thing went down?
Absolutely, and then I'll defer to Peggy to speak about it. But it's actually the Cass Doctrine codified in South Carolina. Mark Howard, Peggy's brother, was on a man's property. The allegation was that he was outside of a man's house by the truck by a detached garage, and he was shot through his side, piercing both of his lungs into his heart, probably about a football field or more across the street from the individual's house. So he landed, he was riding his bike, and the individual stated that Mark Howard was by his garage, and when he opened the garage, he thought Mark Howard had something, and he shot Mark Howard by his garage. But Mark Howard's body ended up across the street in the neighbor's yard. I don't know how far it was, Peggy. Was it like 100 feet? How far was it?
132 feet away, Mark's body was found.
How many bullets went into the neighbor's home.
There were two additional bullets. There are three bullets altogether. One bullet that went through the easement of the neighbor directly next door to the murderer's house, and then another bullet that went across the street adjacent to the left of where Mark's body was found, and then Mark Howard's body was found in the house, in the yard of the house across the street from the individual. Of course, he was not arrested. He was not charged. In South Carolina, we took the case all the way to the state's attorney, and they sent it back, and they said that they were going to refuse to charge the individuals based on the Castle Doctrine codified in South Carolina.
Now, for the attorneys on the panel, the shooter, you know, this was 3 o'clock in the morning, of course, but the person technically was not posing a threat. Because if he was riding away from the shooter at the time that, or the homeowner.
He never touched his house, and he never touched his house. Unlike Florida, the Castle Doctrine in South Carolina is really about your home, your place of business, or your car, and it deals with forcible entry and then the imminent threat, the threat of imminent danger of great bodily injury or death. The man came out of his house, opened the garage door, and, you know, what, based on, you know, our investigation, we gathered all of the evidence, the ballistics, everything, and basically, based on what we gathered, the gentleman may have shot through the garage, but he did not shoot Mark Howard in front of the garage because there was no way, based on the intensity of Mark Howard's injuries, that he was able to pedal a bike for 132 feet across the street and land in the neighbor's yard. So again, you know, it's a matter of pursuit and how you're justifying reasonable and how you're just reasonable fear and how you're justifying imminency.
And see, that's the question tonight. You know, as we talk about these different cases, in this particular case, Mark Howard didn't have a weapon. He was leaving the man's property at the time of the shooting. So how is it that this particular homeowner can stand with or can you stand your ground as his defense and never spend a day in jail?
He was never charged.
Never charged or arrested.
His interview was 8 minutes long is all they interviewed him for, and he changed his story many times.
Can anybody address that? Any attorney on the panel?
Well, I can chime in there, Terry. That sounds just like a bad prosecutorial decision to me. I don't see how under Florida's version of the law, would not be prosecuted. Is no longer on the property, isn't doing anything to pose an imminent threat. I don't see how you fire a shot and kill a guy when he's across the street. So even under Florida standard ground law, that sounds to me like a case that should have been prosecuted. So if it was not prosecuted, I would attribute that to poor prosecutorial decision making, not to any version of the standard ground law.
But I think that it also deals, and you know, that's my criticism, and it goes back to what the attorney was just saying about, you know, Trayvon being dead, Mark Howard being dead, Bobby Gadsden being dead. You know, then you have to begin to look at the law as a violation of the victim's 14th Amendment rights to due process, regardless what you're talking about. If a person is dead, then automatically they don't have the ability to come in and testify in court. And so the law is automatically going to lean to the testimony of the assailant or the testimony of the defendant if it even gets to that point. So, I mean...
What about this, though? What if in the Trayvon Martin case, during the struggle on the ground, Trayvon Martin had grabbed a gun and shot and killed George Zimmerman, and Trayvon Martin was on trial? Wouldn't you want the stand your ground provisions to apply to the benefit of Trayvon Martin?
If I absolutely would, and if George Zimmerman were the one being followed and he had a reasonable fear, I absolutely would. If Mark Howard was actually breaking into the man's house and he had a weapon and he was threatening the man and or his family, I absolutely would. But the problem is the misapplication of the law. And where, you know, I'm still trying to figure out, you said that with the case of Mark Howard, it's a poor prosecutorial decision. I completely agree. But, you know, where is it that the people who are victims and the family members who become victims of these laws, where do they get justice when the law itself doesn't address the posthumous rights of the individual who was murdered?
But to say where do they get justice assumes that you have empirical knowledge of what actually happened. What the state had to do here was prove beyond and to the exclusion of every single reasonable doubt that George Zimmerman did not act in self-defense. And what the jury found is that the state didn't meet that burden because the fact is there wasn't a whole lot of evidence as to what happened in the final minutes before the shot was fired Exactly. But that's what's at issue in a murder trial because that's the killing that's the subject of the case.
But the empiricism logically does not begin
at the point of death or at the point of altercation. So when you're talking about empirical knowledge, we all know, based on the facts and the evidence that was presented, that George Zimmerman got out of his car. He followed Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin, we know, we all know, Trayvon Martin was attempting to get away and was concerned and feared for, you know, for his safety. It was expressed. So that's where the beginning is. And then all of a sudden we just skip over that point and we get to the point where George Zimmerman starts to fear for his life, and the whole beginning of the empiricism is eliminated from the discussion. And that, I think that that's problematic. And then so the law only applies to George Zimmerman, and then we sit here in these discussions and we talk about, well, you know, Trayvon is not here and he's not on trial, and, you know, the law is what it is. But at the point where a person is murdered and they lose their right to defend themselves or to assert their rights or to be afforded equal protection under the law, then we do have to begin to question either the law itself or the application of the law.
But the law would not apply in situations where George Zimmerman was deemed to be the initial aggressor. And what the jury verdict represents is a finding that the prosecution failed to establish that in those 4 minutes, George Zimmerman did something that would deprive him of the right to assert his right of self-defense. Again, I'm not taking sides here because as to what actually happened, because the fact is I don't know. But I do know is that it's legally the state's burden to prove it. They didn't meet that burden, and that's what the law calls for.
Well, I agree with everything Tom just said in terms of the initial, except for one part. I don't see how you can't find that George Zimmerman was the initial aggressor. Trayvon Martin was walking through the neighborhood. Trayvon Martin wasn't walking up to George Zimmerman. It was George Zimmerman that said on the radio, they always get away with it. No. When he said they, was he referring to the people who robbed those 8 homes, or was he referring to the fact that he's African-American? I don't know. But I know this. There was no testimony that I heard or read about where Trayvon Martin went up to George Zimmerman seeking him out based on everything that George Zimmerman said in the interview to the police and on various television interviews. Is that he began to question Trayvon Martin about what he was doing there and why he was there. And you know what? Trayvon Martin didn't like being questioned by somebody who wasn't a police officer. Now, in terms of what Tom said, in terms of what happened in those 4 minutes, we don't know. But we do know this. And I don't see how anybody could argue separately. If George Zimmerman never approached Trayvon Martin,
he'd still be
Trayvon Martin is alive. And George Zimmerman would not have been arrested because Trayvon Martin didn't seek George Zimmerman out. George Zimmerman sought Trayvon Martin out. So I don't know how you can say he wasn't the initial. I mean, if you want to say it, he wasn't being an aggressor because all he did was question Trayvon Martin, well, obviously we don't know what happened.
Well, how did he have a right to question him because he wasn't law enforcement?
Well, I mean, he wasn't law enforcement. If you're asking me, could he have a right to question him? I mean, you know, you always have the theoretical police in a citizen's arrest, or a citizen can question somebody. But Trayvon Martin had every right, and I can tell you, I have won jury trials, and I'm sure the other lawyers on this panel have won jury trials where their clients have been charged. In the state of Florida, you can be charged with resisting without violence, and resisting with violence, and there's a defense. I know it's to resisting without, I believe it's to resisting with, but I don't want to be 100% sure that if it's an illegal arrest, or if they're stopping you for a reason you're not supposed to be stopped for, you have an absolute right to resist that arrest if it's illegal. An absolute right. It's an affirmative defense. What I would say to you is that if a police officer is acting unlawful in the way they seek to arrest you or detain you, you have a lawful right to resist. And it's, in fact, an affirmative jury instruction in the pattern jury instruction, which to acquit you. So, my problem is that I have a hard time believing that anybody could make an argument that Trayvon Martin was the initial aggressor, in that, you know, he had iced tea and Skittles in his hand, and he was going back to watch, you know, the NBA All-Star game. He didn't seek George Zimmerman out. George Zimmerman sought him out. And that's the tragedy in this case. Zimmerman initiated the contact, was told to resist, initiated it anyway, made a statement about how they always get away with it. And, you know, a few minutes later, Trayvon Martin was dead. And I do agree, and I just want to be clear, as a criminal defense attorney, I think the jury verdict was correct. And as a citizen, I think the fact that the jury verdict was correct is tragic. And my problem is with the law.
And I agree too. And I have to, and me with my radical self, I absolutely agree that based on the trial itself, if I were to just look at the way that the evidence was presented in the trial, that I would also have to agree that the jury verdict was correct.
Peggy, I'm sorry, and we never allowed to ask your question. Did you have a question for the panel?
Well, my question, I heard one of the attorneys say that morally, nobody asked him what he morally thought of this. Now, I mean, what's happened, it's happening everywhere. We are a white family. My brother, it was white too. Morally, people are not even taking human, if there's no human to people anymore, they can just go out and kill. I just don't get how the law is allowing them, because there's going to be no consequences. And it's happening everywhere.
The belief when this law was passed was that by, and I will say as a defense attorney, it has been an enormous aid to us. The belief was that people needed to have a right to defend themselves. And the way the law was previously, as Troy said at the top of the show, they had to retreat. They had to run away, literally, unless lethal force was within their sight. So if I don't see you pointing a gun at me, I can't shoot you. And people believed, you know, that's unfair in the sense that what if you fear imminent bodily harm? You have to be able to defend yourself. And hence, you know, stand your ground in this law and other states. And my response to that is, you know, I heard the doctor talk about empirical facts. Here's an empirical fact. And I wish I could tell you the source, and I wish I could tell you the statistical amount. But murders have gone up.
That's a fact.
Since this law has passed, murder has gone up. And that's why I say morally, I haven't been asked my opinion. And, you know, I mean, it's bad for business. All right, well, I'll answer you. It's bad for business, defense attorney, if stand your ground is dismissed. And, in fact, it's popular. And the governor, Rick Scott, ordered a task committee to go around the state and decide what to do. And a lot of times politicians will have a task committee to review things when they don't want to make difficult decisions. And guess what? The task committee, comprised of prosecutors, defense attorneys, police officers, clergy, that just keep it the way it is. So I'll take it. I think morally this law is tragic, and I think it should be repealed because I think it's been exploited to the point where people like me can go into trial and get our clients acquitted when the problem is, I'm not saying our clients should go to prison for life, but I'm saying there could be justifiable use force. And the problem is, under Governor Bush, we passed 10-20 life, where just the use of a firearm could get you 10 years for having it, 20 years for firing a gun, and life for shooting someone. And it's
Marissa Alexander.
That's what happened to that case in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's been a mess. That's what happened.
Nowadays, though, the people, the citizens know. All they got to do is say, I was in fear. That's all they have to say.
No, it's not that simple.
In the state of South Carolina, West Columbia,
yeah,
I guarantee it is, because that is what they told me.
Well,
they told me that I could be getting in the wrong car at a Walmart purely by accident, and that car owner see me and kill me, and there's nothing they could do about it because their hands are tied with the way the law is.
Okay. You have to remember that the reasonableness standard is what the jury is deciding. They are the finders of fact. They are determining, a jury allegedly of your peers in a particular area is determining whether you feel that the harm that was facing you was reasonable or not. Now, you take a situation, for example, let's say you have an older woman who's being attacked by a younger assailant, and he's unarmed. Now, at what point would you determine that, you know, she's in fear for her life? The guy's perfectly capable of strangling her, beating her to death, whatever. He doesn't necessarily need a weapon to do that. So, I mean, in one way, the law removed it. It's like, we're not going to have you try and overthink the situation. But obviously, from a prosecutorial standpoint and a defense standpoint, they're going to have to establish, hey, was it reasonable for a person under this particular given set of circumstances use the force they did? You're always going to see mistakes. You know, I can speak from experience, and it's kind of a sad story. When I was in college back in the early 80s in Georgia, the white supremacists decided to march down North Avenue in front of Georgia Tech, where I was going to school at the time. I took it upon myself with a couple of guys to form our own little protest, and I threw a 32-ounce beer bottle at one of them, and it hit a guy in the head. I was taken into custody by a large African-American officer who drove me 3 blocks away, let me out of his car, shook my hand, and said, have a nice day. Now, was that proper? Absolutely not. I should have been charged with battery, maybe even assault with a deadly weapon, who knows? But, you know, the system is imperfect. You're going to find these things that occur all the time, which is why we have a jury system that is charged with using their set of experiences, their moral values, their social experiences to determine whether this particular circumstance that's put before them is appropriate or not. I mean, we're micromanaging somebody else's values.
And you know what? And I think that that is the point, Terry and attorneys, that he just hit the nail on the head. And from a sociological perspective, you will not be able to separate, which I argue is the reason why the prosecution and defense agreed upon a 6-member jury as opposed to a 12-member jury. You're absolutely right. And in the eyes of true justice, justice is supposed to be this blind, objective reality where you get these moral people who are able to look at the evidence and weigh the evidence objectively. But when you start talking about subjective concepts like determining what is reasonable and what is a reasonable fear, and then you invoke history of people's experiences, the history of race relations and race dynamics in the United States, then you are going to get people who may look at the evidence, but are ultimately, let's keep it real, no jury is completely objective. Everybody brings to the table with them, as he just said so poignantly, everyone brings to the table with them their set of morals, their values, their experiences. So when you're talking about a man and a woman and reasonable fear, the woman may be a bodybuilder, but if she's smaller than the man is automatically going to get the brunt of those experiences. History has shown and statistics have shown that men are more likely to be violators of women than women men. So if a woman claims reasonable fear, she's probably going to get that objective reality. That's going to be the reality that people can bond with. And when you're talking about black men specifically in America and reasonable fear, black men just by nature through our own media presentations, through the mainstream media presentations, through the statistics that are going to the prison industrial complex, black men automatically invoke this concept of fear. So when you have a black man at the table and the concept of reasonable fear is invoked, how many jurors are you really going to get who are really going to be able to look at a black man from a subjective perspective and then apply objectively the evidence? And I think that's the problem with the law.
Y'all, if you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic Stand Your Ground Law, Self-Defense or License to Kill. That's what we're talking about tonight. So if you have a question or a comment, we got a dynamic panel tonight. Get on the phone lines. Call us up at 347-850-8390, then press 1. Again, if you have a question or a comment, we got 3 attorneys out of Florida and a sociology professor. It doesn't get much better than that, y'all. So if you want to talk about the Zimmerman trial, any other trial where Stand Your Ground was used as the or the killer's defense, get on the phone lines. We're going to go to area code 111111. Your number's blocked. Show you. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Yeah, hi. The problem with the Zimmerman defense was that the instructions, I read the instructions. The instructions seemed to me to be kind of fair. But nobody took into consideration whether or not Zimmerman was actually telling the truth. They didn't see the beginning of the confrontation. If they had seen the beginning, it might have been a different type of trial. I happen to think that the verdict was just one legally. Morally, somebody had died, and we don't know whether or not he actually had a real intent to kill or to murder once he got out of the car. Because we don't know whether or not Trayvon Martin jumped out of the bushes or not, like you said. The only person we have in terms of a person's, I guess, real eyewitness from beginning to end is the perpetrator himself.
Okay.
The thing is that if I'm being followed and I don't know who the person is, and that person doesn't have an identification, doesn't have a uniform on, has an unmarked car, nobody really introduced whether or not the person who's being followed had the right to confront the person who is the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I would say, what are you doing? Now, according to Zimmerman himself, he said he reached into his back pocket to get a cell phone. At that time, if I'm confronting you, if you're confronting me after following me, I'm going to knock you in the head, too. I'm going to knock you out. I'm not going to wait for you to pull out a knife or a gun. But we don't know whether or not Zimmerman had true intentions to kill this guy. I think if he hadn't called 911, and if they had found him without that 911 call, he might have been convicted of murder because he had no other alibi except for calling the 911 dispatcher.
Carrie, anybody want to address the caller? Okay, Colleen, do you have a question for the panel?
I have a question for the attorney.
Okay. Thank you, caller. Go ahead, Zozo. And then we're going to go to 304-675.
I wanted to ask the attorneys because, again, I'm not a lawyer, but the caller just mentioned, we don't know about George Zimmerman and blah, blah, blah. Well, I mean, even in closing and even in instruction, they talked about the fact that George Zimmerman had told lies, and everybody knows that he told lies and there were some inconsistencies. And one of the things that both the prosecution and the defense attempted to convey was, that the inconsistencies that he told, and the witnesses, the inconsistencies that he told were really irrelevant or they were minute. Well, I know that they have something in the law called falsus in unum, falsus in omnibus, and it's something that can be implemented in jury instruction, that if you lie about one thing, you lie about everything, and so what you say is basically discredited. Can the attorneys speak about that and where it could have been, if at all relevant, in jury instruction or in the prosecution's presentation?
Yeah, I can answer that. Andrew Ryer in Miami. There are jury instructions that indicate you're entitled to consider part of a witness is credible, none of what a witness is credible, and you're allowed to consider inconsistencies in the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
The jury are the finders of fact. They make credibility determinations, not the judge, not the lawyer. The only
mm-hmm.
person who determines whether they find the witness to be credible is the jury. In my opinion, without speaking to anybody who prosecuted or defended the case, the reason the defense made a decision not to call George Zimmerman is if he testified, they believe he would have been found to have been impeached on certain issues.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the video of his interview with the detective, he had no answer for why he continued the pursuit after he, why did he get out of his car when he was instructed not to? I mean, so, and it's not just for George Zimmerman, it's defense lawyer many times. If I thought my client would be nervous or if I thought my client, would just, we always ask juries in jury selection, one of the great fears that people have is public speaking, to explain why we don't call our witnesses to the stand. Because the jury is not allowed to hold the fact that a defendant invokes his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent against them. But we all know as defense attorneys that juries want to hear from you, especially in a case where there's a murder or there's death. The jury's going to want to hear an explanation as to why that happened, and they're going to want to hear from the defendant. But many times we decide not to put our defendant on the stand, and I'll tell you why. We're really good at cross-examination because it's our way to impeach the officers in Florida. One of two states where we're allowed to take depositions. We're allowed to question the police before the case ever goes to trial, which is a great tool because now we have their statement under oath and we can impeach them with it in trial. Well, you can't do that with a defendant, right, unless he testifies in a stand your ground hearing and then testifies again in trial. So the answer to your question is, if the jury decides that your testimony is inconsistent, they are instructed by the court that they can consider all or part of their testimony as credible, and they are the finders of fact as to the credibility of the witness. So Zimmerman did not testify, but an interview he gave to the police, which was videotaped, and an interview he did, on Fox News was also played. And I think too effective, even though the verdict didn't reflect it, I think it damaged it. And I think the state actually argued in their closing, from what I saw, that the answers that he gave was incredible. And then even though, the problem is, a TV interview is not under oath. The interview was effective one. But George Zimmerman testified, and it would have been under oath, and the jury found his answers to be less than credible, then they absolutely could have used that against him to reach a verdict of guilty.
Hey, y'all, we're going to area code 304-675. Good evening.
Carrie?
Carrie, how you doing?
Carrie, I don't want to be rude. I really appreciate you having me on, but I have a 3-year-old that has a merciless disrespect for my ability to do this. So I'm going to have to...
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, Andrew.
No, thank you so much for allowing me to be part of it, and it's a real pleasure.
Thank you. Area code 304-675. Good evening.
How you doing? Your house, the man's out there in your driveway on a bicycle, shoot him dead and shoot two houses up. One house, you shoot a hole through the wall that goes through an exercise ball. It lands in the entertainment center. Now, what would happen if it didn't go in the entertainment center and it went through a child's bedroom and hit the child or hit the grandma or hit one of the parents? And that man out there, they waited 18 minutes before they called 911. But if it had killed two people, would it still be justified as the Lexington Police Department saying? Is it still justified to go out of your house and shoot a man dead?
Troy Weber, Andrew Ryer, did y'all understand his question?
Not really.
I can tell you this. In Miami, Troy,
let me put it this way. He says his gun was in the glove compartment of his truck. But in the police video, the pictures, it was clearly right there beside his driver's seat in his truck. But he come out of the house with another pistol.
So
you allowed to drive around with a loaded gun in your truck?
And you are. In the state of Texas, you actually are allowed to drive around with a loaded gun in your truck.
In South Carolina.
Well, I'm not a lawyer in South Carolina. I can tell you Florida allows that, too,
really?
If you have a concealed carry law permit. But what I'm telling you is this.
You have a permit.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have it, then you can be charged with carrying a concealed firearm.
Well, why didn't they charge him?
Well, I heard Tom, before he signed off, that he thought it was a bad prosecuting decision. I'd agree with him. But I can tell you that in Miami, sir, we had a case.
Corrupt.
I can't answer why. I can tell you there's political pressure. I don't know if the majority of the town was Caucasian or African American. Definitely, race plays a factor in so much of what we do. We like to think it doesn't play a factor in the law, but it's hard to make that statement credibly because it plays a factor in everything. It plays a factor in
Andrew and Tom. I'm sorry, it's Andrew and Troy. What can they do at this point? The family feels like they didn't get justice. Is there anything, because the man was never charged, so is there anything that they can do right now?
They can pursue the
U.S. Attorney's Office under Title 1983
done it.
To pursue civil rights. And what did they say?
There is no response. There is no response. We have we've done
Richard
the DOJ
Williams
1983.
Got away with
he did. We did DOJ Section 1983, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm an activist and a sociology professor, so I'm not able to, I don't have the insight. So if any of you all want to get with the Howard family, that would be good. We took it all the way to the, we got SLED to reconsider it. It went all the way to the state's attorney's office, and they sent it back, and they said that they weren't going to do anything. They weren't going to arrest him, and they stood by their decision. And this, in spite of the fact that his body, we have the pathology report. He was shot through both of his lungs and through his heart, and there's just no way that you're riding a bicycle 132 feet. With a puncture wound through your lungs and your heart. There was no blood spatter evidence in the driveway at all and nothing to corroborate the story at all, and they still were not arrested. So, yeah.
Is there any recourse?
That's a tragedy.
It is.
Are there any recourse? Well, I would certainly recommend that the family do a civil lawsuit, and in the Simpson case, even though O.J. Simpson was charged and acquitted, the family was able to successfully collect, now monetary means, nothing to the Howard family, obviously. But I can tell you that there's nothing to stop the Howard family from seeking a civil remedy, which would only be monetary, even if it's just a paper judgment. One thing that would be very rewarding is that I believe you said Williams is the name of his suspect. He would have to testify. He would not be able to invoke his Fifth Amendment right in civil court, and he would have to testify. And you could question him, and I would highly recommend that the family pursue any and all civil remedies they have and continue to contact, especially in light of Eric Holder's press conference where he indicated that these type of matters would be pursued. I would highly recommend that be done.
If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, underground law, self-defense or a license. Y'all, we still got two attorneys on the phone and a sociology professor. If you got any questions on any of these high-profile cases, like the Marissa Alexander case, we're going to talk about that next. Nobody understands why this young lady got 20 years. We're going to talk about that. We're going to also talk about some other cases that were high-profile recently. Mr. Spooner, Henry Spooner. Spooner, I believe his name was, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the elderly white man that went out and shot the young black teen that was pulling in his garbage. He said he felt like the young teen had stolen some things off of his property, some weapons. And so he took the law into his own hands, and he shot the young man. And he recently was found guilty of murder, and I think they gave him life in prison. And they found him, I think he was trying to have an insanity plea, but they said that they found him sane to stand, or however you, y'all going to have to help me with his term. What do you call it when he was trying to say he was insane, but they said that they found him sane to stand trial, so therefore the charges would stand. So we're going to talk about that later. But the question is Marissa Alexander. Let's talk about her, because so many people, and I tried to get her people on the show actually tonight, and we weren't able to coordinate the time and what we could and could not talk about. So we passed on that for tonight. But that said, that young lady, from what I understand about her story, her and her husband had issues with violence. I understand he had been abusive to her, and I think he had moved out of the home, and he returned on this particular day, and he kicked in the door. Marissa Alexander, from what I understand, felt in fear of her life. She ran to the garage where she had a weapon. She pulled the gun, and I think she said the reason she did not retreat was because the garage door was broken. So she says she felt she had the right to stand her own ground, and so therefore she shot a warning shot into the wall. How is it, Florida attorneys, that she ends up getting 20 years? I mean, something's very off.
I'll first say I don't claim to be an expert on tax of the personal of the case. I wish I had time to follow every fascinating case I heard about, but my understanding was she did leave the house and go back to the garage and then re-entered the home. That's my recollection of news reports that I have read. And I think in that case, what you're dealing with is just the finder of facts. The jury saying in that situation, well, how could you believe that death or great bodily harm was imminent to you when you took it upon yourself to re-enter the dwelling where you eventually fired that shot? I'm not saying that she didn't have fear, but I could see how the finder of fact in that situation might conclude that the fear, even if reasonable, it wasn't a reasonable fear with regard to imminency of the danger posed.
Okay, the thing is, I guess we just don't understand, for those of us that don't live in Florida, how is it that the minimum mandatory sentence on just firing a weapon is 20 years?
That's a neo-black code.
I mean, Troy Weber, how is that the case?
Because that's what the law says. I mean, it's very hard when you're dealing with firearms in Florida. You fire a weapon, and those are the stakes. That's what you're dealing with. So Florida has come down hard on that. It's sort of ironic that you come down harder on gun crime, but at the same time you liberalize the use of weapons with regard to the standard ground law. It's sort of a contradictory policy, but that's what the point is.
Black code, that's what it is. And just as the war on drugs, the drug issue and the incidence of gunplay in Florida and pretty much any major city in the USA, I think that's a response to race and crime. And race and use of guns. And there is a disparate application of the gun laws depending on whether or not you can afford great attorneys like Andrew and I think it's Tom or what have you. I think that's what it is. And I think we ought to keep that at the forefront. Well, at least for me, I have to keep that at the forefront.
For me, I do think that is the best explanation of that dichotomy between what the objectives of the standard ground law, which really expand the use of weapons, and then this sentencing scheme, which punishes the use of weapons more harshly. I would agree with that statement. I can't find another explanation for it.
You're my hero.
You know what's so frustrating?
You're my hero.
Can I just say one thing? You know what's so frustrating is that in this case, for this poor woman in Jacksonville, the state has the right to deviate and waive and that really hasn't been publicized. I'm sure Troy has. I can tell you, I've got 10, 20 life waived on cases. And, you know, it's just a situation of reasonableness. If the prosecutor feels that 10, 20 life is unduly harsh, then they have a right to waive that. And the judge can't waive it, but the state can. In fact, the judge had to send the person under 10-20 life unless Angela Corey's office, which ironically is the same office that lost the case of George Zimmerman,
malfeasance,
turned around and would not find any grounds to deviate. Now, Troy and I both know that if the state attorney's office had chosen to waive 10-20 life, then they can do it. They just have to write a closeout memo explaining any kind of mitigating factors that caused them. And I can't tell you, and Troy, jump in here if I'm wrong. I can't tell you how many cases I've had where the state has had weak faith. My clients fired a gun, and they have offered well below 20 years, which would be, you know, if you fire and discharge a firearm, it's supposed to be an automatic 20 years. I've had the state waive that because they knew the alternative was a not guilty in a trial. So they'll say, hey, how about probation? I'll be like, really? And they'll do it. No, they'll waive 20 years. They could have done that.
to give you a concrete example in that regard, I just did an aggravated assault case. It's the firing of a weapon in a home. I had the charge reduced to possession of a firearm while intoxicated. The guy got 12 months probation and some community service. Very similar facts to the Melissa Alexander case. So there is this very broad discretion that prosecutors have to either waive the 1020 or to reduce the charge, amend the charge to something lower, even a misdemeanor offense in my case.
And in addition to that, because I don't have any cases because I'm not an attorney, but I do have statistics. If you look at, Carrie, the women who are victims of domestic violence who actually murder their husbands or their partners or their abusers, you know, the law is really lenient when it comes to prosecuting that because the mitigating circumstance is the history of proven abuse. And so even with Marissa Alexander, regardless, and I'm not sure that she actually left the home. From my understanding, they considered her going to the garage, actually leaving the home and coming back into the house. And her explanation was that she couldn't leave out of the garage door because the garage door was broken. But in spite of that, she didn't kill anyone. She fired a warning shot, and there is a history, there's a documented history of domestic violence where her husband had been arrested and where she had been hospitalized due to his violence. And again, and you know, when you talk about it, and, you know, I know I'm the black lady on the panel, but when you talk about the social constructs, and in the case of Mark Howard, the social constructs that make people social misfits, then the application of the law gets really, really tricky when it comes to that.
Well, I can tell you, you know, and I'm the white guy on the panel, and I'll tell you this. I mean, we seem to feel the same way, Doctor, because I'll tell you, just what Troy said is so true. I mean, Troy did great lawyering on a case where 1020 life should have applied, yet it didn't. I can give you the example of many cases I've had where the state is no action cases. It's being dismissed them, even where 1020 life should have applied. What is underreported in the Alexander case, and it's so frustrating to me, is that Ms. Alexander was offered, I think, a sentence, and I know, Troy, this case is closer to you in geography than to me. She was offered 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the state themselves waived 1020 life and said, hey, you don't go to trial, we're going to waive 1020 life and give you 3 years. But she chose to go to trial. Because she couldn't do 3 years, she was raising her children. So what happened? He goes to trial. And now, oh, you know, 1020 life is all that applies. I'm sorry. You can still make a recommendation of sentencing for a mitigation motion. The defense could have filed a downward departure motion, and the judge could have granted it if the state was willing to waive 1020 life. But Angela Corey's office was not willing to waive 1020 life, and I wish I knew the congresswoman who wears the hat. She's great on this case. She specifically met with Angela Corey, and Angela Corey said, hey, we offered her 3 years. She went to trial. She was convicted. There's nothing we could do. Excuse me. There is something you can do.
Mm-hmm.
The state at any time, up until and including sentencing, can waive a minimum mandatory or enhance with a minimum mandatory. So they still could have offered 3 years or recommended to the court. They chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
They chose not to. And that's...
Let me ask you that. With Marissa Alexander getting all this media attention, what do you think the outcome's going to be when she goes back to court?
Well, I haven't heard anything as to what's going to change. I mean, Troy could maybe speak to this because he's closer. They can file a Rule 3 motion, which means that, they can do a direct appeal. And if the direct appeal loses, they can file a 3.850 motion, which is ineffective assistance of counsel, which very well maybe she had.
Mm-hmm.
And under a 3850 motion, if they find ineffective counsel, they can set aside her conviction.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything specific about what they're planning to do, whether it's going to be an ineffective assistance of counsel motion or an appeal. I really don't know.
What happened to Ms. Alexander is something that Troy and I know well. And Troy, you can speak to this. You're punished if you go to trial. If you
mm-hmm.
go to trial, you should have a right to go to trial in this country.
Right.
You have a constitutional right to exercise a right to trial. Here's one little problem. If you lose to send a message to the other inmates,
yes,
and the other people who they're trying to get to take pleas,
yes,
they will make an example of you.
Yes.
Now, there's no statute that says you have to get a higher sentence for going to trial and losing. Yet, Troy, jump in here. How many times do we see a case where a judge will punish you for going to trial? And if your client testifies, they'll say, hey, not only did you go to trial, but the jury didn't believe your client and he was committing perjury because he testified. And that's an unwritten rule in appellate courts as to why sometimes, even if you have great appellate grounds, they'll uphold the conviction if your client testified. I mean, Troy, jump in here if I'm wrong.
Well, I'll just say in Duval County, they call that the trial tax.
They call it the what?
The trial tax.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what he's saying. I mean, it's the same in Miami. It's, look, if you go to trial and lose, you're going to get a higher sentence than if you don't plead. And that's exactly what happened to Miss Alexander. She didn't want to go quietly into the night for 36 months in state prison. So she went to trial, and now she's doing 20. And, you know, I mean, Angela Corey was able to waive the Min-Man before trial. Why couldn't she waive it after trial? Because they won't do it.
Speaking of Angela Corey, what's going to happen to her career after the Zimmerman trial and the Marissa Alexander trial?
Well, I don't know, Troy, if there's anybody running against her, but, I mean, that she's not exactly close to glory on either of those two cases.
Well,
I think she'll be reelected. She's got a lot of support with law.
Well, my approach to Angela Corey, and I actually have petitions going on, and not that they're going to go anywhere and not that anybody is going to pick it up or, you know, present the bills or anything else that I suggest, but based on what I've seen, and I'm just a layperson, and, you know, you have a right to file complaints, but we have really started a movement around calling the, and you all can correct me, the number is there, but to charge the office with misfeasance, malfeasance, and nonfeasance, because the things that I saw and I witnessed, and I have attorney friends as well, and you all can speak to it from your perspective if you choose to, but some of the things that we've witnessed and we witnessed during the trial, you know, I'm a conspiracy theorist on one point, but, you know, there were some concrete things that, you know, the prosecutor should have. Had they been defense attorneys, you know, there would have been, you know, greater grounds for a defendant to claim that it was misrepresentation or they weren't represented adequately. And so we're looking at having complaints filed against her office, her and her office, for misfeasance, malfeasance, and nonfeasance.
Well, I think there were a lot of things that went on in the trial that
absolutely
really baffled me.
Absolutely.
As
you know what? Please elaborate. What baffled you? You're an attorney. What baffled you about the trial?
Well, you call an officer, and I don't recall the officer's name, but basically all he testifies to is that Zimmerman's back was wet, it was covered in grass, he was bleeding. To me, that's a defense witness.
Yes.
That's not
yes
a case witness. Why are you calling him?
Sure.
It's almost as if you're throwing the case. It was
yes
so bizarre. I really had no explanation, and some of the other witnesses, it was as if they were not prepped, and even some of their experts
yes
talking about the proximity to where the shots were fired. Well, I don't know why, as a prosecutor, you're bringing attention to that fact. To me, that supports the defense's theory
yes
that Trayvon Martin is on top. Yet you're giving emphasis to a fact that really helps the defense. It's strength.
I can think of two more things that were crazy, if I may, really quickly. I mean, why would your lead detective, why would you allow your lead detective to testify that you thought that George Zimmerman was telling the truth?
Yes.
It's called for speculation.
Yes.
It's completely inappropriate, and I didn't hear an objection.
I'm sorry.
It was called to the jury. I mean, who cares whether a detective thinks that George Zimmerman's telling the truth? First off, it's irrelevant.
Yes.
False for speculation.
Yes.
And I was watching the TV going, are you kidding me? And then you have your medical examiner come up there, and he writes notes for sample questions as to how
yes
we should answer them. And he's surprised that the defense attorney's going to want to see them.
Yes.
I mean, to me, honestly, it was amateur hour.
Yes.
And,
really?
And some of the other
state witnesses, for example, the girlfriend, when she's impeached on her prior inconsistent statements, it It's as if she doesn't know how to react. It's as if she was never told, by the way, you're going to be asked about this. It was as if
mm-hmm.
there was no preparation
mm-hmm.
with that witness, and that looked terrible in front of a jury because
mm-hmm.
it was a 10-minute ordeal with argument over whether or not she lied.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just giving more and more emphasis to a fact that the state should have been very protective of.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Rachel Gentile. And Rachel Gentile was the prosecution's star witness. Why was she not prepped? Why did she appear not to know what she was doing up there?
That's what's bizarre. I couldn't answer that question.
Nonfeasance.
So tell me this. If she's the prosecution's star witness, what would be the normal procedure, seeing that she's young, you know, she's more urban, you know, she's a little rough around the edges? Why is it that somebody didn't call her in and prep her? I mean, what would be the normal process?
Well, they're supposed to do what's called a pre-file.
Mm-hmm.
And in a pre-file, they will say, hey, I'm going to ask you the following questions, and you need to know this ahead of time. And they'll go, I'm going to ask you, bum, 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 bum. And this is what, you know, I think your answer is, because you don't want to, you know, have the witness lie, but you want to say, I believe your answer is going to be this
mm-hmm.
is it. And this is what the horrible defense attorney is going to do. You know, and you're supposed to prep the witness. Now, I don't know if Rachel Gentile was prepped or not, but I have a little different perspective. I mean, I really thought it was very unseemly, some of the comments made about Rachel Gentile, because she's a kid, you know. I mean, she didn't ask to be put in this position. She was
mm-hmm.
talking to her friend. She's from my neck of the woods up here in North Miami Beach. And, you know, I have two daughters and two sons. And, I mean, to think of my daughter as a 17-year-old being questioned by 30-year defense attorneys, I mean, you're going to be able to take advantage of her age. And I think, you know, she did the best she could. And maybe because I was sympathetic to her, you know, I thought she did a good job. And
mm-hmm.
I think what the hit that Troy was putting on is that, you know, the defense, the prosecution lawyers did not do a good job of protecting her the way they could have. They could
Ooh.
Have objected. And they could have made her, you know, I would have got up there and closed it if I was one of the prosecutors and said, look, you know, Rachel Gentile is not a professional witness. She's not an expert. She's not getting paid for her testimony. She's just somebody who lost her friend. And, you know, one of the things that baffled me about this case was sort of the, you know, I don't want to say, you know, Mark O'Meara is a fellow defense attorney, as Troy and I are, and you never want to imply, you know, how difficult that job is. And it was an extremely difficult job for Mr. O'Meara, not on a legal standpoint, but on a social standpoint, because there was so much pressure exerted to prosecute Zimmerman. But, you know, he called the parent, Trayvon Martin, where he was saying, you know, of course you don't believe your son, you know, you don't want to believe. He asked this of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you don't want to believe that your son could have instigated this. And I was thinking, my God,
mm-hmm.
if I was Trayvon's mother, I would have said, you know what, I wish I didn't have to be here, but your client killed my son. You know,
mm-hmm.
it seemed to me that the Martins had too much grace in class to do
too
that.
Too much, absolutely.
But, you know, they would have been well within their rights to look at the defense attorney like, you know, I don't want to be here. You're calling me, and your client killed my son. And what's the answer to that? You know what? There is none.
Wow. Well, let me talk about another case that was just in the news this week, and I think everybody can learn a little something. Terry Brady's at a Houston gas station, or she's at a Houston gas station, and she leaves the inside of the store, and she's heading toward her vehicle. A man approaches her. He's got an umbrella in one hand, and it's questionable whether he had a knife because that was invisible from the video that was online. Anyway, they're having some type of communication between each other, and at some point, the lady goes to her car, and she pops the trunk. And the man was several feet away from her at the time, and she gets out a rifle. And she then takes the rifle, and she, by this time, the man is getting closer to her. She takes the rifle, she points it at his feet, and she shoots. And at that point, he jumps, and then he slaps her. Well, she staggers back a few feet, and then she aims, and she shoots him 5 or 6 times, killing him. And then she takes her cell phone out of her purse, takes a picture of him lying there, dead, and then she leaves the scene. Now, in this particular case, she's invoking stand your ground. My question is, was the first shot okay and the remainder of the shot not okay because it went from, getting rid of a threat to the point of overkill, or was she not justified at all? Because if you look at the video online, in my opinion, it looked as though she had an opportunity to get in her car and leave the scene. He was several feet away from her, and at the time when she popped the trunk. So is it a possibility that she could be charged with murder?
Absolutely.
Really?
I don't think there's a black and white legal answer. I think this is one of those cases left to find her fact. But if we look at it in two ways, one way, I think, from the defense perspective, would be she had this invisible fear. She doesn't have a duty to the street. She fires a warning shot and confirmed her fears. Was the man continued the physical altercation to slap her? And that reinforces her fear, so she fires the second shot, which hits the target. But the other perspective is, you never had the reasonable fear, you were just shooting. And I don't think there's a black or white answer to that. It could be prosecuted, even in a stand your ground state on those facts, but you can see how the evidence might apply in that situation, depending on the juror's perspective.
Wow. Andrew, what do you think?
The thing that stands out to me is the amount of shots fired. I think, you know, Kerry, you hit on that too. I mean, okay, let's. I think the great question that which you asked is, what if it was one shot? I mean, maybe one shot you could see, but you said she fired like 5 or 6, and I'm sorry, but you know, I mean, you're shooting a kill without regard to human life there, and that shows to me, state of Florida, all that is a depraved difference, which is murder too. And I think you've got a great argument if the case were in Florida, which it's not, that that's depraved indifference for human life by simply firing so many times. It's outrageous.
Dr. Zoe Spencer, you saw the video. Did I leave out anything?
I don't think I saw that video. I don't think I saw that one. I want to go see it, but I don't think I saw it.
I think everybody should Google this. Just Google the Houston lady shoots a man at a gas station, and she shoots and kills him. That was this week. And I just found that a situation in which if she used stand your ground as her defense, first of all, I saw a room to leave the scene and maybe call police. I saw a time that she could shoot one time and still get away and remove the threat. So I just question, you know, what was really going on. If she knew the man, which I understand based on the news report, she did not know the man. When they were speaking with each other, allegedly he was making sexual advances at her, which were not appreciated, of course. And so therefore she felt like he was threatening her, and that's the way. I mean, that's the reason that she.
But
time will tell. But I think the reason I opened the show with the song Wild Wild West is because
absolutely
it almost seems as though not every confrontation, but too many confrontations are ending with deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll ask y'all, you know, as we're coming down to our last 15 minutes in the show, you know, what would y'all change about the stand your ground law? I mean, I told you in the intro what I thought should be revised about it. But, Troy, we'll start with you. What would you change about the stand your ground law?
Well, you might tweak with the standard of what degree of force has to be used against you. Possibly that it's got to be maybe take out the great bodily harm and it's a reasonable belief that the person is going to cause death. And that would raise the stakes, I think, for the defendant. And that could apply in situations where deadly force is used. But I think you have to be careful in trying to eliminate this no duty of retreat rule, because prior to the enactment of standard ground, you had equally absurd cases where a person was the genuine victim of an attack. And because they did not do everything under the sun to retreat, they are charged with murder. There's a famous case out of the 2nd DCA from, like, 1984, for example, where a man is beaten down next to an open car door at a gas station. And he eventually pulls a gun out of his pocket, fires, kills one of his men. And because he did not first attempt to get into his car and drive off, as he's being beaten down, he's convicted and sent to prison. And I don't know what the charge specifically what the charge was, but he's sent away because of that. And I think it poses the question, why should the victim in that situation owe his or her attackers a duty? The attackers who are committing violent acts, why should the victim have a duty imposed on him or her as a result of the illegal acts of the attackers? That's the situation you get in, I think, if you go back to the old common law rule. You will have equally absurd results where victims are sent to prison because they first don't on the duty they are deemed by the law to owe to their violent attackers. That's the problem with just doing away with the law altogether.
Wow. Dr. Zoe Spencer, revision or repeal?
Well, I am really ultimately about the repeal because I do not believe that the world is ready for stand your ground, and I do not believe that the world is ready to really objectively negotiate no duty to retreat. But in the meantime, I have actually sent to a few of the state senators the Trayvon Martin Clause bill, and I'm hoping that it'll get somewhere in there where the law will be reformed, and it is looking at chasing, any pursuit, any act of following, chasing, or pursuit will exempt an individual from immunity and protection under self-defense as an act of provocation. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get the pursuit in the forefront, that if you chase someone, if you follow someone, and that you initiate unwarranted contact with an individual, that you cannot claim self-defense and you cannot claim any protection under Florida's immunity clause.
Andrew Ryer, or revision?
Revision. I do agree with Troy that there were some really tough situations when you had a duty to retreat, which, you know, if somebody's coming at you but you don't see a gun, you have to run away, which seems a long time ago, considering what happened in Trayvon's case. But the revision I would make is twofold. I would put the defense have an affirmative duty to demonstrate that there was documentation, some kind of proof for their belief that they were in reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm. Right now, all that you need to kill somebody in the state of Florida is an ability to demonstrate to a judge that you were in reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm. And if you can demonstrate that to a judge, then you don't need anything else. I mean, your case doesn't go to trial. You win it on a motion to dismiss. So how do you make it tougher? Because I think you can drive a truck through that kind of law. The way you make it tougher is you have to say something like this. You know, you need more than a reasonable belief. You need to show some kind of proof that you were in fear of imminent bodily harm. Now, I'm not saying the proof has to be the other person has to possess a firearm, but I have a real trouble with the amount of murders that are happening since this law passed.
Mm-hmm.
That you can basically shoot someone who's totally unarmed, be there black or white, merely because you personally are in reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? You know, I could go out tonight and I could say, well, you know, I don't like the way that guy's looking. And somebody looked at me like that a year ago. And when they looked at me like that a year ago, they mugged me. And this guy's looking at me the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I kill him. Well, if a judge believes that I was in a reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm, whether that person was armed or not, the homicide could be justified. And I don't think that's right. I think there have been abuses of the system. And one thing we've all said tonight is if the jury came with the right verdict based on this law,
mm-hmm.
Well, if we change this law, then this verdict may not have been right. And one of the ways you do that is you eliminate the National Rifleman Association from writing the darn law. I mean, there is a conservative think tank called ALEX, and ALEX is funded by large corporations to literally come up with these stand your ground laws. And there was attention given, and they work with the legislature. And at the time Governor Scott signed Stand Your Ground, or Governor Bush signed Stand Your Ground, there was a member of the National Rifleman Association lobbyist group who was right there at the signing ceremony. And that should tell you all you need to know.
Absolutely.
And that's the problem. You know, how much power does the NRA have? And even after Trayvon Martin, this case, this law, still under popular vote in polling, stands up. And, I mean, I'm of a personal belief that just because the majority likes it doesn't mean it's right. I mean, there was a time where the African-American couldn't vote in this country, where the woman couldn't vote in this country. That might have been popular. It didn't mean it was right. And I just feel that, you know, we can't let popularity guide us. And I think that there needs to be some kind of affirmative proof for the defense that they would have to show some kind of documented belief that the person was armed. Because if you put in a provision that the defendant must feel that the victim is either armed or has the ability to carry out, you know, well, you already have the ability to carry out. But the problem is, what can you do? Can a person carry out without being armed? I really think there should be a requirement that the victim has to be armed, or there has to be a reasonable belief that the victim's armed. And unless you have that provision, unarmed people will continue to be shot, and those shootings will continue to be justified, and that's a tragedy.
And Carrie, can I pick you back on that a little bit?
Martin's position as well is George Zimmerman was never given any toxicology testing. So how is it that the shooter is not tested, but the victim is?
Because the victim's given
is dead. Autopsy.
And when the victim's dead and there's an autopsy, you're going to do that. And obviously Zimmerman didn't have an autopsy. But, I mean, I'll put it like this and try to correct me if I'm wrong. If I get into a car crash and I kill someone, even if I haven't been drinking, my driver's license gives the police the right to take my blood involuntarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see how in a homicide there should be the same type of requirement.
Well, can I speak to that on the implied consent law, that there's got to be a reasonable belief, number one, that you're the cause of the crash, that you actually caused it, and there has to be a reasonable suspicion of some sort of impairment. Otherwise, under the implied consent law, you would have a right to refuse.
Another issue
Can I piggyback on something that Andrew was saying? I thought he made a great point. You know, going back to the defense having a higher burden to show self-defense, you know, to get an instruction on self-defense in a jury trial, all you need to show is what they call a scintilla of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Any evidence to support self-defense, and you get the instruction. One other tweaking to this law that might be done, and this is very similar, I think, to what the other attorney panelist was saying, is that perhaps the defense in the midst of trial could get that self-defense instruction. It has to do a little bit more than a scintilla. They've got to meet some kind of higher standard, or else the jury will not hear the standard ground self-defense instruction.
You know, another thing I want to throw in there is this. We know that George Zimmerman was taking temazepam and Adderall. They're known to be drugs that cause hallucination, agitation, aggression, mood swings. Taking that into consideration, you know, when we use the term reasonable, if he was in fact doped up, I would like to use that term, doped up, on those drugs, the way he looked at what's considered reasonable isn't reasonable at all. You know, so
well,
the whole thing could have been made up in his mind.
You have have to remember, though, Kerry, the reasonable standard, Kerry, is it's an objective standard under the law, meaning it's what a reasonable person in general would do, not what was reasonable from George Zimmerman's perspective. It's an objective standard. So, again, it's the jury deciding, well, even if he's coked up on something, was it still reasonable or not?
But the jury thought that what he did was reasonable, which is scary. Because, again, nobody brought in, unless I missed this in the trial, y'all, and I did not catch every day. Did anybody ever mention what drug George Zimmerman was on? Because I never heard it.
No.
I didn't hear it.
No.
It was never. Why did the prosecution miss that?
Well, I'm sure the defense, your defense attorneys, but can speak to it, but I am sure that they would have fought tooth and nail to make sure that never entered, especially given that they fought tooth and nail, the prosecution. Well, they didn't really fight tooth and nail, but they wanted to make sure that Trayvon Martin's toxicology reports didn't get in.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, you know, the whole term of racial profiling. You know, the first show I did on this one, on the George Zimmerman trial, it was about all the non-emergency calls that George Zimmerman made to police,
mm-hmm,
total. You know, that he made, like, within a year's time, racially profiling black men. Troy, Andrew, you know, answer me, how is it that the prosecution allows the defense to get away with not allowing that to be brought into evidence? That's crazy. How did they miss that? How did they miss it? They didn't miss it. Why didn't they argue stronger for that to be brought into court?
Nonsense.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, what you're saying is, if I understand your question right, is why did the state not make it an argument that what Zimmerman was doing was racist? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. He racially profiled. In terms of, if you go back and listen, and most folks have the file down, but there were 5 recordings of George Zimmerman calling Sanford Police Department, basically stating each call started off exactly the same way the call that on Trayvon Martin started off. Young black male walking through the neighborhood, he's looking suspicious. Not in one single case did he say they were doing anything. They were just always looking suspicious. Isn't that racially profiling black males?
Yes. And, I mean, I guess we do what's called motions in limine, and I don't know if there's a specific motion in limine on this, but Troy can speak to this as well. The defense attorney and the prosecution can move to keep various things out. For example, you know, I think there were some motions to get into what Trayvon Martin did on Facebook. Well, why is that relevant? There were motions to get in that Trayvon Martin had smoked marijuana. Why is that relevant? You know, there were motions to get into Trayvon Martin's school records. Why was that relevant? Let's say that Trayvon Martin had terrible school records and he was expelled from Michael Kropp High School, which he was not. My question would be, does that mean he didn't have a right to walk through that neighborhood with skills in ISD? Of course he did. And, I mean, you know, what makes this stuff relevant? I don't know. But you can file a motion limiting. And I think what your question is, Terry, is why should they have been allowed? Why didn't the prosecution do a better job of saying that what Troy Zimmerman did was racially profiling? I don't think they were prevented from doing it. And I think, you know, one of the things that I heard, there are trigger words. And when you hear the trigger words, they always get away with it. As a white person, I mean, what does that mean? To me, that means he's saying African Americans get away with it. I don't know how there could be any other reading of that. And if I were the prosecutor, I would have been pounding that from the mountaintops. Troy, I'll defer to you.
Yeah, Kerry, I didn't hear the arguments for the motion in limine, so I can't say specifically what the objections were. If I'm just imagining here, an objection to number one, the unfair prejudice outweighing the probative value, because maybe the argument was that it wasn't clear enough. It wasn't a clear enough example of racism these past calls. The other argument may be that this was character evidence, really, introduced more to assassinate the character of George Zimmerman as an alleged racist than it was, you know, useful evidence that had probative value. I'm not taking a position on that. I'm just saying that may have been an argument I could see a defense attorney making in that situation.
Can I interject too, Carrie? I don't think that it was ever presented, and that goes back to why I strongly believe, and I'm glad the attorneys agreed, that I believe that there is room and there's grounds for malfeasance, misfeasance, and nonfeasance. And the same argument that Troy just made, you know, of it being prejudicial, I completely agree, and I would know that any defense attorney would argue vehemently about that evidence being introduced. But if a prosecutor is really attempting to prove a case, and they're diligent about attempting to prove the case, you have to introduce the things that are relevant to the case. And they wanted to dance around race and talk about profiling without saying racial profiling, but we all know what profiling means. That's first and foremost. And then the second thing is when you're talking about prejudicial, I always wondered why they put the white lady who was robbed by the two black men in the house with her young child and the rusty knife. I still hear her testimony. And for a second, I'm like, okay, well, why would they put her there as the second-to-last witness? And the two questions, or the one question that I would have asked as a prosecution attorney, if I allowed her testimony to be introduced, because, again, what are you, you know, What's the relevance of it, and is it prejudicial? Because the jury is looking at her like, oh, my God, the black kids broke into your house and, you know, while you were there with your child, and they're relating to that. And I waited for the prosecution to ask her, were any of those gentlemen Trayvon Martin? And they never, ever asked her that. So when you're talking about that whole – the whole establishing character and creating not necessarily illusions, but creating grounds for the jury to perceive, those are things that are crucial in creating those things for the jury to perceive.
Hmm. Y'all want to address that before we get out of here? Troy or Andrew?
Andrew, go ahead. I'll be first. Okay. I mean, I really think that the doctor's hit on some things, and as a sociology professor, is trained to do it. I mean, one of the things we say, doctor, in every trial, it's called voir dire, where we select a jury, and it's
absolutely
French for tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I always tell my juries is, look, we can't pretend that we don't have biases. We can't pretend that we don't have prejudices. All we ask you to do is be honest. There's no wrong answers in jury selection. We want to hear if you're biased, not because we want to condemn you. We want to know not to pick you as a juror, you know? So I personally, and I'll defer to Troy, I view my job on jury selection as taking the bias out.
Excellent.
So I will ask a question like, if you hear somebody testify one way, and then the police officer testifies the exact opposite way, and one person's the defendant and the other person's the police officer, are you just going to believe the police officer because he's a police officer? Or are you going to say, hey, maybe that police officer has a bias or a motive in lying in that he wants to get a conviction or he thinks he'll get paid more if he gets a conviction as opposed to an acquittal? So I want to hear that. I want to ask questions that are going to elicit answers where somebody says, I can't be fair. Hey, you hear from everything the state says, and then I don't call my defendant. Are you going to be okay with that? Or even though the judge has told you my client has a right to remain silent, are you still going to hold that against him? I want to hear what your client has to say, and if he doesn't testify, I can't be fair. That's a dream answer to me, because that's the only way I'll know that somebody who can't be fair will not sit on my jury. Because if what we have to look for, Troy knows this just as well as I do, we have to look out for people that will lie to get on a jury just to convict, right? Because there are some people that you know want to convict your client.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I have police officers in Miami-Dade, well, you know, this is a Miami-Dade case. Well, yeah, I work with Miami-Dade, but I won't be at all unbiased. I mean, I know that answer is
right.
When he goes, oh, yeah, I can totally believe that a police officer will lie. Yeah, you're going to go back to your buddies in the same department that you found for the defendant who pointed a gun at a Miami-Dade cop. Sorry, I don't believe that. So I will ask all types of different questions to get that juror to give an answer where he will say, in whatever his answer is, I can't be fair. And once I get that answer, I'll get that jury eliminated. So I want to hear your bias, and we all have biases. I'm a lawyer, I have biases.
Mm-hmm.
We all have biases, and to pretend that just because we're in a courtroom, there's no bias there, I'm sorry. Or to pretend that an all-white jury isn't likely, more likely to acquit somebody for shooting an African-American than an all-black jury, I mean, that's just silly.
Absolutely.
Okay, y'all, listen, closing remarks. Attorney Troy Weber with Hussein and Weber out of Jacksonville, Florida. Your closing remarks. And also, can you mention about your article that you wrote on Stand Your Ground? Can you mention that?
Oh, sure. if you'll just get 400 or 500 unique visitors a day, you'll just Google Hussein and Weber Stand Your Ground Law, Florida. The article will come up first or second entry on the search results. So there's a big, long article. It's kind of a scholarly discussion of the origins of the law and how it was going to apply to the George Zimmerman case. My closing remarks are as follows. Without condoning anything that George Zimmerman did, and I'm very careful here tonight not to make moral judgments because I don't think that what he did was advisable. And personally, I do think he was being a vigilante citizen, and I do think he had racial prejudices. But what I think the verdict came down to in the George Zimmerman case was the failure of the state to meet its burden of proof and to show beyond and to the exclusion of every single reasonable doubt that George Zimmerman did not act in self-defense. I think it was a failure of proof, and I think it was a lack of evidence, and not so much the result of the literal language of the standard ground law. I think had they presented their case differently, there very well could have been a different outcome.
Wow. Sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer, closing remarks.
Thank you for letting me go after Troy, because I am going to defer to his principal argument, and then my closing remarks are going to be that I think that it was deliberate. And again, my three words are malfeasance, misfeasance, and nonfeasance. Those are my closing remarks.
Attorney Andrew Ryer out of Miami, Florida, closing remarks.
I've really enjoyed this discussion.
Me too.
I've really enjoyed listening to Troy. It's nice to know on the other end of the state we can still have the same beliefs hundreds of miles away in totally different jurisdictions. And I mean, I guess the way I feel about this law is that as long as we have people like the good doctor on the beat, there's always a chance for reform or malfeasance findings. And I think that the body count will continue to rise as long as this law is there. And, look, I'm a part of the system. I've won 4 trials where people have been shot or killed and gotten dismissals because of this law. And it's benefited my clients. But, you know, I'm not just a criminal defense lawyer. I'm a father.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a citizen. I'm a member of the community. And what's good for me professionally doesn't make it good for the community. And when you know, you have backdoor deals being made and conservative think tanks funded by multinational corporations coming in and promulgating laws that are pretty much handwritten by the National Rifleman Association, then you have these types of outcomes. And, you know, we've talked about the Zimmerman case. We haven't talked about Columbine. We haven't talked about Newtown, Connecticut. And, you know, I mean, what's to stop one of these people with a gun from not just shooting Trevon Martin, but going into a room full of third graders and shooting them too?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are in, you know, you played the Wild West at the outset. I mean, I'm sorry. Norway has very strict gun control laws. And, you know, other than one madman who went on an island and killed children in a camp, you don't have these types of things happen. And the only way this is going to stop is when the legislature changes the law. And the only time that'll happen is when we as citizens vote out the people that are there now and get in some different people, regardless of their political leanings or regardless of being a Republican or Democrat, and just get people that are willing to do something about this law and not simply keeping because it's popular or keeping it because it rating with the NRA, but get rid of it because it's increasing the body count.
I agree. Enjoy tonight's topic. Wow, and the guests, awesome. That's all I can say, absolutely awesome. I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Zoe Spencer. Also, thank you to Troy Weber with Hussein and Weber in Jacksonville, Florida. Troy, can you give them a website?
I will do my best. I'm pulling it up here. We got, it is HusseinandWeber.com/stand_your_ground .html. That's the webpage.
Okay. And phone number for Troy is 904-444-3952. Also, we'd like to say thank you to Attorney Tom Wright, who had to leave us earlier this evening. He's with Siegel & Wright out of Boca Raton, Florida. And I don't have their website available, but the phone number for them is 561-620-8200. And last but not least, thank you to Attorney Andrew Ryer of Miami, Florida. Andrew, do you have a website?
I do. It's Andrew F. Ryer, P.A., or you can contact me directly at Andrew@RyerLaw, RIERlaw.com. And my telephone number is 305-899-1212.
Okay. Listen, y'all, that's three excellent attorneys.
Thank you.
What?
You're doing great, Dr.
You all are great. Yeah. I love to see you guys.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you all. And listen, we do this each and every Friday night right here on Center Stage. Come back next week. We'll be doing it again. Thank you to the audience for listening tonight. Thank you again to my panel. And we're going to close out again tonight, y'all, with Wild Wild West. We'll see you next week.
fun.